Church History Matters, episode 27.
Welcome back to another episode of Church History Matters Podcast. My name is Ruben Rosales.
And I'm Joseph Knowles.
And we are going to simply play a podcast for you and say that it's ours. About church history. I'm just kidding.
No. I have no less than three books down here, and now I tipped over my water.
See, so I checked one, two, three history books.
Mm-hmm.
My church history book from school, which was early right. church history to the Reformation, just mm-hmm. past the Reformation, and then two separate books that I bought on my own that were, you know, that I just was like, oh, is this church history mm-hmm. stuff? I want this. And so yeah. I bought it, and like they just had, I think, a total of 2 pages of what our topic is over today. And so I had to go to the internets.
Although, well, I mean, I'll say a word about our sources probably toward the end, since that seems to be a hot topic.
Well, now, so I do have to include, and I don't even know the names, so we'll just provide the links to the other podcasts.
There you
go. I did listen to 2 podcast episodes from a different, I don't even remember, I think it was from Southern or mm-hmm. Southwestern.
Okay.
Baptist Theological Seminary.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows if they even, I mean, I don't know anymore.
Yeah. Who can say?
Yeah. But, so what are we talking about today? Oh, before we get into that.
This Week in Church History.
Let's get to This Week in Church History.
Yes. So, Lord willing, we will be releasing this episode Wednesday, July 14th. And the event that I have for you occurs the day after that. So, July 15th, 1838. And this is the date of an address delivered before the senior class in Divinity College, Cambridge, Sunday evening, 15 July, 1838, by, care to venture a guess?
1838. Yikes, man, I don't know. 1838.
You'll recognize the name.
I don't know.
But probably not for this. It was by Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Oh, well, yeah.
Yeah, so obviously you recognize the name. We all
have
probably
one of his
read.
Books.
Yeah. Nature.
Yep.
Yep, and he's known for some of his poetry, which people probably read in high school, but maybe not so familiar with the address that he gave to basically the seminary graduates from Harvard in 1838.
Seminary grads from Harvard?
Yeah, it was a thing, you know? There were 7 seniors that year. Only 6 of them apparently were in attendance for this speech that he gave, and it was a doozy. If you remember from American literature class, Emerson was known for transcendentalism. You can look up the address. You can find a transcript of it online fairly easily.
What is transcendentalism?
Yeah. So, to give you a flavor, this was too much even for the Unitarians.
Oof.
Yes. So Harvard Divinity was kind of center of the Unitarian church world in New England at the time. And they said, this is really bad. Like, what you just gave to us is just truly, truly awful. So, among other things that he does in there, denies the validity of miracles, basically denies the divinity of Christ.
Oh.
And he's... He was
a predecessor to Martin Luther King Jr.
Well... That's maybe a topic for a different time. But yeah, you can read it, and it's very flowery language, but when you think about it, it's just kind of gobbledygook. Mm. What is he actually trying to say? And basically, be a good person. Goodness is within you.
Oh, no.
Right, yeah. So transcendentalism is, it's a movement that was really gaining steam in the 1820s and 1830s, and Ralph Waldo Emerson is probably the most famous. Now, he himself was a Unitarian minister in Boston until he got into this stuff. And then, I guess, his own integrity compelled him to resign his position there, and he dove into this. But it's the idea that goodness is inherent in people and in nature, and formal religion and Christianity have kind of corrupted that. So
so this is Kantian philosophy. That's all it is.
Probably definitely influenced by that. And also, I mean...
Well, it says influenced by Platonism, Kantian philosophy, Immanuel Kant. Obviously, you should know Plato. If you don't know Plato, please...
Read up.
Yes. Please go ahead and study on him.
Yes.
It was a reaction to rationalism.
Yes. Very touchy-feely, New Agey.
Trash.
Yes. Sadly, yes. But this address that he gave on July 15th, 1838, was kind of a watershed moment where, well, there's no turning back now. Mm-hmm. Like, I've even ticked off the Unitarians, which maybe probably was part of his goal. But he was definitely drawing a line in the sand and trying to get people to come along with him. And it did not go over well. He was denounced by all the people at Harvard College, who, even though they were Unitarians and had other major problems of their own, could see, well, he's basically an atheist now.
Yeah.
Which functionally he was.
Yeah.
If you wouldn't just all out call him a pantheist. There's nothing new under the sun. So even on July 15th, 1838, he's supposedly giving this new thing, but it's
more of the same old
it's
trash.
Ancient pantheism. Yeah. That's all it is. Anyway, that's This Week in Church History, July 15th, 1838, which I believe is 183 years ago.
But the question is, did he cite his sources?
I don't think he had to worry about that, because I don't think he had any.
Probably, yeah. Satan.
Yep. I don't think there's a manual style citation for that.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. What are we talking about today?
Wow, so well.
So much.
Goodness gracious, so much. Again, it's something that I've wondered for a long time. I mean, we're gonna. It seems like all around a whole lot of stuff, but the main question that we kind of were asking is who are the Anabaptists,
mm-hmm.
and is that where Baptists come from? As some who will not be named have claimed.
Yes. So, that word itself might be unfamiliar to some of the listeners. They've never heard the word Anabaptist. If you're listening to church history podcasts, probably you have. But, you know, we want to explain for folks that are less familiar. What is that? I mean, literally, what does that mean?
It means a rebaptizer.
Right.
Essentially. So it's, again, the Roman Catholic Church was the predominant visible church at the time. There was already essentially three visible churches during this time. You would have your one that we talked about before, the Ethiopian,
mm-hmm. The Eastern Church,
Ethiopian Orthodox, and then there's the schism that happened in 1054 AD.
Mm-hmm.
That created the Orthodox, the mm-hmm. Eastern Orthodox, which is separate from the Ethiopian Orthodox.
Right.
And then there's the Roman Catholic Church.
Right.
And so the Reformation is getting ready to kick off.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some stuff happening.
Yeah. And that's where our discussion is going to focus, is these groups that grew up around the same time as the Protestant Reformation. If you go back far enough, that term Anabaptist had been used exclusively by opponents of these groups.
Right.
And if you go back, you know, you can find other groups like the Novatians, which were a sect in the 3rd century, so you're talking the 200s.
Yeah.
And they would have been denounced as Anabaptists because they rebaptized people. But the reason, and we'll get into it when we talk a little bit more about the Anabaptist theology, the reason the Novatians rebaptized people is they said, well, your baptism doesn't count because it was done by the Catholic Church,
right.
And they're corrupt.
Right.
So it's the guy who administered it to you, not the baptism itself. So they weren't against infant baptism per se. They just said, that priest, sorry, you just got wet because he was the one who did it.
Right.
Not because the administration of the sacrament itself, they had a theological problem with that.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I feel like we could go into infant baptism discussion, mm-hmm. and when did that begin, and
mm-hmm.
topic for another day.
Put a pin in that. Put a pin in that. Kind of hard to, but on this one, but.
But I guess if for at that time, the only ones who would be baptized as adults were those that were new converts.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else, if they were in the church, they were right. doing infant baptism.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So one of the sources that I definitely want to mention, because this was very helpful to me, was the Global Anabaptist Mennonite Encyclopedia Online.
Did I do it?
Yes. Now, if you go there, it's at gameo.org, so gameo.org, I guess. And if you go there, it looks like Wikipedia, but it is not a wiki. So know that this is basically the online reproduction of the print version of the Anabaptist Methodist Mennonite Encyclopedia, and it's edited by Anabaptist Mennonite people. So it's not like anybody can go on there and change the article.
Right,
so
it's not a wiki.
Right. See, all that to say, it's a reliable source.
Yeah.
So, and they had a good, I think a good working definition of how do we characterize these groups, because there are a lot of different viewpoints.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, the Anabaptist that we're talking about still exists today.
Yes. Yes. You can trace the lineage all the way back. And basically, even though you have these basically three main groups, I think,
right.
they all shared a basically synergistic view of salvation, mm-hmm. so human and divine cooperation. Baptism, obviously they did not do infant baptism. It was only adult baptism of professing believers. And then thirdly, they developed a doctrine of what, I'll attempt the German pronunciation here.
Nice. Ooh, man, good luck.
Gemeinde Christentum.
You sound angry enough.
That's about as angry as I can get, I think. But that's the translation basically would be church Christianity. So
okay.
they're saying it's an ecclesiology that's centered on the congregation in contrast to the clericalized territorial churches, both Catholic and Protestant.
Mm.
So maybe that's where we could start with these, is when we're talking about Can they even rightly be classified as part of the Protestant Reformation?
I would say no,
mm-hmm.
but
and I would agree.
It did happen around the same time,
right?
As the Protestant Reformation,
right. They were definitely contemporaries.
Yeah, 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 for sure.
And they shared a, I guess if you talk about the magisterial reformer, so Martin Luther, Zwingli.
Right.
Calvin.
Well, Zwingli was
right.
very and, intimately.
Yes. So
involved.
They're very closely aligned yeah. with them, and they line up on a lot of things in seeing, hey, the Roman Catholic Church is doing this just wrong. Like, we reject the Mass, we reject the idea of transubstantiation.
Yep.
And all these things. So they're on the same page with Luther and those guys on those things, but then they used to go to say, well, you guys aren't going far enough.
Yeah.
Like, this has to stop now.
Yeah.
We got to stop it all.
They I think we should talk about how and exactly when. So what year did you have for the first, the beginnings,
mm-hmm.
the fanning of the flames that began their Reformation?
Right.
So according to one of the sources that I checked, it was after the theses were nailed to the door.
Yes.
That their Reformation began.
Right. Correct. So uh-huh. I'd be looking at 1525.
Okay, so this one went to 1522.
Okay, a little bit earlier. What event did they start with?
They pinpointed it to 1522, Erasmus's. And Erasmus, it's amazing. I was listening to this, and it's amazing how much, when you look back at church history, all of these different seemingly unrelated things began to happen,
mm-hmm.
and they eventually coalesced into
yeah.
a major thing.
Oh yeah.
So Erasmus is part of the reason why we have the New Testament in the way that we do,
right?
Or the Bible mm-hmm. in the way that we do. So, but he translated the Great Commission he did a paraphrasing of it after listing all of the things that that people must know mm-hmm. before being baptized. So this is kind of, you start to see that thought process right. begin to form yeah, yeah. about Anabaptist and their requirement that someone have a certain mm-hmm. amount of knowledge and then profess that faith
right.
and then being baptized. He stated in his, when you have taught them these things, if they believe what you have taught them, if they repent of their former lives, if they are ready to embrace the gospel teaching, then bathe them with water in the name of the Father, the Son, and Holy Spirit, so that by this sacred symbol they may trust that they have been freed from the filth of all their sins by the free benefit of my death and have now been admitted into the company of the sons of God. Let this symbol be sufficient for all who come over to the profession of the gospel, a symbol that is easily available everywhere. So that was in 1522. So that mm-hmm. was, that's what kind of planted the seed in that translation. And then in 1526, in response to Bondage of the Will,
mm-hmm.
which was written by Luther,
right?
He said this, quote, "Had the church not after long hesitation chosen to defend such things as transubstantiation, purgatory, the refusal to repeat baptism, and infant baptism, I would have preferred to suspend judgment on these matters." Essentially, he's saying, if the Catholic Church had not responded to these things in the way that they did and defended them, then it would have been a non-issue. We could have just kept going the way we were. He would later describe what the Anabaptists called Christian discipleship,
mm-hmm.
which to them was, hey, you've got to do all these things. You've got to be learned in all these different things, and then we can baptize you. So Erasmus was trying to contradict that, and he ended up coming up with proposing something that was essentially turned into confirmation.
Mm-hmm.
Which are you familiar with Roman Catholic sacraments? One of the sacraments is confirmation, which is nothing more than essentially a rebaptism.
Mm.
But they don't want to call it that, and they right. cannot call it that because of their, magisterium that they have. That
right.
if they, whatever they teach from the church, it cannot be changed.
Right.
So they lock themselves in to where they can't say that, oh, well, we're going to do actual discipleship mm-hmm. and then verify that they believe it and then sprinkle them with holy water and call them confirmed.
Right.
Yeah. So they were called novitiates.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1526, the Paris Faculty of Theology condemned it, said it was essentially a second baptism, which eventually, that's what the Catholic Church embraced eventually.
Right. So. Yeah. And maybe it's a good time to note, at the time, and this goes all the way back to Justinian, one of the Roman emperors, and Theodosius also, I believe, where rebaptism, along with denying the Trinity, were both considered capital crimes.
Oh, wow.
Like, those were heresies that you could be executed for.
And a lot of Anabaptists did die.
Right. So it's persecution for their religious belief, but it goes back centuries before mm-hmm. these Anabaptists came along.
Right.
So Erasmus definitely is one of those streams, and he's kind of the humanist stream
yeah.
that influenced the Anabaptist movement.
I think they said it was what led to, because it was Zwingli, which was the Swiss mm-hmm. Anabaptist, which became the Hutterites.
Right. Yeah. And, well, maybe talk about that now. So that's one of the other, if you find a source that says, well, we really kind of can pinpoint where this whole Anabaptist thing started, that's where they look. So they'll go to Zurich, Switzerland. Zwingli is getting his Reformation effort there underway, and he's really starting to gain steam. But it's precisely because Zwingli and the city council are not changing quickly enough and thoroughly enough that a number of men who had been with Zwingli felt that they had to break away with him. So they actually had initially preached against infant baptism, or at least preached some sermons and gave some public addresses that made them think, well, he's moving away from this. He's eventually going to land on infant baptism. Well, eventually he backed off from that. And the reason was he was still in this paradigm of this union between church and state. So,
oh yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So we're not going to abolish the mass right. unless the city council tells us to abolish the mass. We're not going to institute adult baptism unless the city council goes along with it. And the city council was not going along with it. In fact, when they refused to stop infant baptism, it came to a point where people were not bringing their children within the appointed time to have them baptized into the church there in Zurich. So they said, no, you have to. You must bring them. You're a citizen of Zurich. You're under our authority, and we say that you do have to baptize them. Well, for people who, and we'll get some names here in a second, who their conscience would not allow them to do that, this kind of became, I mean, things came to a point. And they came to a point on January 21st, 1525. And on that evening, there's a number of men. They met in the house of Felix Mantz in Zurich, but it's within like shouting distance of the main cathedral there in Zurich. So they're right under the nose of Zwingli when they're doing this. They meet up at his house where George Blaurock asks another man named Conrad Grebel to baptize him.
Yep.
So Blaurock kneels down. Grebel pours water over him. So it's baptism by pouring, not by immersion.
Not true baptism.
Right. you're in trouble now. So Blaurock is baptized by Grebel. Then Blaurock gets up and does the same to about a dozen or so other men who were there in attendance. And this continued. So they would they went and baptized a number of others who agreed with them. Mm-hmm. And began meeting in their own assemblies, which was illegal. Observing the Lord's Supper together, which was also illegal.
Well, I wonder, how did they do that? Like, what did they, well, that would be, like, what were their views on the Lord's Supper, I wonder.
Right. Yeah, so as far as they're concerned, they're, well, they have a different doctrine of the church, and we get into that. But...
Yeah, they obviously rejected transubstantiation.
Right.
But I actually had a chronicle, a Hutterite chronicle from the 21st January prayer meeting, and it says, and this is what is from that 21st, the chronicle from the 21st January prayer meeting, which reads as follows. And it happened that they were gathered together when a great fear began to grip them and overcome them. Indeed, it penetrated to the very core of their being. They fell on their knees and cried out to Almighty God of heaven and earth, calling on Him as the one who knows the hearts of all, to give them strength to fulfill His holy will and grant them His grace. Neither flesh nor blood nor human ingenuity had driven them into this extremity, for they were well aware of what the consequences for their actions would be, and what they would have to suffer because of them. When they had finished praying, George of the house of Jacob, known as Blaurock, arose and begged Conrad Grebel, or Grebel is the way they say
Grebel,
it.
Yeah.
For God's sake, to baptize him with a, quote, true Christian baptism upon his confession of faith. And then, of course, others, seeing this, also began to do the same. This was the beginning of the separation of the Hutterites.
Yep. And I thought it was interesting about this, the Hutterite Chronicle. Now, I don't have that, but I do have an excerpt from it in the Spiritual Anabaptist Writers. It's part of the Library of Christian Classics, Ichthys edition. And they have an excerpt that's been translated. But this chronicle was an actual document that had been carried by these Hutterites from the 1500s.
Wow.
Basically, they would add to it over the years. And it had been lost. So it existed only in secondary sources. Mm. Like, you'd have a book like this that would cite it, but you didn't have the chronicle itself until they found it. It was recovered for scholarship among the most cherished possessions of the Hutterite colony at Bornholm in South Dakota.
Wow.
So in the late 19th, early 20th century, I think, was when they recovered it. So 400 years after the fact, almost. Wow. It has traveled from, you know, Austria or Switzerland all the way to South Dakota. And it's in this Hutterite colony in South Dakota where they've held on to it all these years. I thought that was interesting about our buddy George here.
Yeah.
Who is either George of the House of Jacob or George Blaurock.
Yeah.
But Blaurock in German means blue coat, which he got the name apparently because, and again, this is from the the Hutterite Chronicle as well. One time when they were having a discussion of matters of belief in a meeting, this George Kajakob presented his view also. Then someone asked who it was who had just spoken. Thereupon, someone answered, "The person in the blue coat spoke." Thus, thereafter, he got the name of Blaurock. So nice. It's just George, the guy who wears the blue coat. And thus is he known to history.
You know, what's interesting about the Hutterites is I met a Hutterite once.
Oh, where was
Virginia.
That? In Virginia, wow. Yeah,
who works at the same place I work, which is fascinating.
That is fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, and I think, I don't know if it was South Dakota, but it was somewhere over there.
Yeah.
In the plains lands.
The northwest
yeah.
plains.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I didn't know that. So if I ever have the chance to meet him again, I'm going to ask him if it was in South Dakota and if he knew of that document. So he ended up becoming saved, coming to true faith, the actual true faith of Christian faith and orthodoxy, because of a missionary who knew that they were there, and he went out and he preached the gospel to them.
Yes.
It cost him his entire family.
Oh, yeah.
They completely kicked him out, shunned him, and abandoned him. Yeah. But they only speak German.
Yes. Right. And
he was born in this country, and he has a German accent. He speaks English with a German accent. I was like, wait.
Where are you from?
Where were you born? Hold on.
But get this. They speak German. German that's kind of frozen in time.
Oh, yeah.
From when the Hutterites left Europe.
Yeah.
So they left most of them in the late 16, early 1700s.
Wow.
So they could go back to Germany today, and you could get by.
Yeah.
But it would be kind of like if you took like a first edition of Don Quixote.
Yeah.
And tried to read it in the Spanish high school. Like, they could understand it.
Right.
Sure. It'd be kind of like one step removed from how most people today think about trying to read the King James Version of the Bible.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's not even the original.
Right, yeah.
Translation of the King James.
Right. So that's kind of the
Hutterite start.
Right. So they branch off from there. But there's also, when you talk about the Anabaptist movement, I'm using my air quotes there.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's also called the Radical Reformation. Or the left wing of the Reformation. I like that one even less because trying to apply, I mean, it has a contemporary meaning, but the original meaning has to do with the French General Assembly during the late 18th century. Like, using that for everything is not is not really helpful. But there were these movements that were similar. They kind of get lumped together, and they have some common influences. But they eventually came to be identified as part of what, you know, capital A, capital M, Anabaptist movement. So there's the one group that grew out of, became the Swiss Brethren.
Yeah, Swiss Brethren.
So those would include the followers of Jacob Hutter, or Jakob Hutter, I guess, if you want to try for the German. And the followers of Menno Simons, who we now know as the Mennonites.
The Mennonites.
And I would call those groups the Anabaptists.
Yeah.
You also have some other groups. And here I'm borrowing from Nick Needham, his excellent work, if you can buy it, 2,000
Years. All volumes,
2,000 Years of Christ's Power. I think there's 5 volumes altogether.
There were only 4. Are there? Because you've always got one checked out.
There is always one checked out. Yeah. Like, I don't own it. I check it out from the church library. But I'm pulling from volume 3 here, which covers the Reformation. And he puts another group under the broad heading of spiritualist radicals.
Mm.
So that'd be guys like Thomas Münzer and some others who were very much of the inner light. We don't need scriptural revelation. We have signs and wonders and this kind of stuff.
Same garbage they were just talking about.
Well, yeah, it's very similar to the transcendentalism. Yeah. I think they were much closer to historic Christianity than what Ralph Waldo Emerson was.
Yeah.
But yeah, that whole inner light idea, you can see where it's already getting off to. Well, it's terrible to begin with, but fuel some of those later things. And then a last or a third group in this kind of larger movement are people that Needham calls the rationalists. They're kind of the opposite end of the spectrum from the spiritualists. They were emphasizing human reason, and that leads them to reject a number of core historic doctrines. including the Trinity.
Well, yeah, so I guess you would have to.
Right, maybe. Because well, the Trinity is a mystery. They're going to be consistent, yeah. Right. We can't rationalize that, so if we can't rationalize it, we can't have it. Mm. The most famous of these is the Italian Faustus Socinus and his uncle, and from their name we get the term Socinians. They eventually would end up, the Socinians being very big in Poland, and they're somewhat associated with, this larger Anabaptist movement, although the Anabaptists they were not anti-Trinitarian. Mm. They had some similarities in that you can't really, they're not Catholics, but they're not Protestants. What are they?
Yeah.
But, yeah, there's a big difference, a wide gulf, I would say, between the Anabaptists and the Socinians.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like you said, the Hutterites are still around.
Buy up plots of land, mm-hmm. and unlike, which we'll get to in a second, unlike the Amish, the Hutterites and Mennonites do not shun technology.
Mm-hmm.
The Hutterites they have simple lives. They do vow to live simply, but they will buy like tractors to do work.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this guy that I met, he's actually, we'll talk about it later, but you actually know his wife, I think, or at least someone that his wife's related to.
Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. But so he would say that they would collect money together and they'd mm-hmm. buy a plot of land and live off that land.
They were essentially communists.
Yeah.
The Hutterites.
Yeah. Communalists.
Right. Communalists. We'll say. Yes. Yeah. We don't want to associate with them. They're not Marxists.
No, they are not Marxists.
Although Marx, interestingly, would look at some of the Anabaptist groups and say, well, look, this is how it can work. So they show up in some of his writings, although obviously he has a total rejection of God.
Yeah.
While God, they would say, is the basis for their communal living.
He was a preacher's kid, wasn't he?
Was that him or was that Ingalls? No, I can't remember now.
I think that was Marx.
It may have been.
I have to double check that. Somebody was talking about it recently, and I feel like it was Mike Rowe, because I've been listening to a few shows lately, the way I heard it. But it probably wasn't. I'm pretty sure it wasn't. But somebody was talking about him recently and how that's how you end up in a situation where you have just enough of the Christian charity
mm-hmm.
and then twisting it.
Right.
But also they said that he didn't see any real transformation in his parents who were, you know, professed Christians. Mm-hmm. And yet they were living in a way that was different, contrary to what he was learning.
Right.
Anyhow, again, we digress.
Yeah. So, well, you mentioned the Hutterites and the Mennonites in contrast to the Amish.
Yeah.
And most of the time, I think, when people think of the Amish, which is why we named this episode Barn Raisin Baptists.
Yeah.
That's Baptist with a D, in case you missed that. It's a little tongue-in-cheek because they're not Baptist like we are Baptist.
No.
Obviously.
Yeah.
But it's interesting how they came to be.
Yeah.
Because they are an offshoot from basically the Swiss Brethren. And, well, we'll come back and talk about the Mennonites, I guess, and where they came from a little bit.
Sure.
But they take the Amish take their name from a man named Jacob Ammon, or Jacob, and trace their origins to the last few years of the 17th century. So around about 1693 to 1698 is when this split is taking happen. So there were a number of issues where Ammon came to believe were very important. I mean, among them was like literal foot washing. Like you actually physically have to get down on the ground with a bowl of water and wash people's feet. And this is not like an optional thing. Like this must
thou
be
shalt.
Done.
Yeah.
Yes. So thou shalt, where God has not said thou shalt, is a problem by itself.
Yeah.
But that the main
first
one,
flag. Oh.
Yes, I mean, for sure. But the main, thing he seemed to be focused on was the thing that the Amish are kind of, I guess, infamous for now, which in German is the Meidung, just meaning avoidance or what we would call shunning. So when we exercise church discipline and you're excommunicated, you're not merely excommunicated, like you're effectively dead. You don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Well, maybe not that you don't exist, but you're treated as if you're a dead person. You've left the church. So we have nothing to do with you. We won't look at you if we happen to pass you on the street. We don't accept your letters. We don't talk to you. You're not allowed back in our house. All of these things. And that becomes a point of contention. So Jacob Ammann he started holding communion services twice per year, which was a departure from the usual once per year. That the South German...
Red flag number.
Yes.
5,000.
So the Swiss and the South German Anabaptists would only do it once a year, but they kind of said, well, we'll let that go. But he invites them basically to a convocation or a meeting. So let's work this out. And this is taking place in the summer and fall of 1693. And there's a number of meetings that happen. But at several of those, he had made the shunning the main point of contention. And he basically demanded, like, either you agree with me or else. And that agreement was not forthcoming. So he said, well, guess what? You're all excommunicated.
You are shunned.
Right, exactly.
Wow.
So he stuck to his guns, and there were some attempts at reconciliation, including, I thought this was interesting, there were some groups of the Amish that admitted, well, you know what? Maybe we were a little, we jumped the gun a little bit. We were a little hasty on the using of the ban. So we're going to put ourselves under the ban as punishment.
You know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of Dwight in The Office.
Yes.
When it was like, you know who would be the best opponent for you? Yourself. So it's like he has to enact all these, his own defenses against himself.
Right. Which is hilarious because he's...
Yeah. He said his granddad was Amish. Okay. Was like his great-granddad. Somebody along his line was Amish.
Yeah. I'm just trying to remember if they ever explicitly said that his family is Amish. It was definitely heavily alluded to in the beginning before they ever said it explicitly. Well, he says he was shunned, like, from the ages of 4 to 6 or something?
Yeah, something ridiculous. Yeah.
Because he knocked over the milk pail or something. I don't remember. It was something crazy like that. So Jacob Ammann, you know, they've got these attempts at reconciliation. They are all unsuccessful, and eventually...
Well, they seem like perfectly reasonable people. I don't understand.
Either you agree with me or you get out of here.
That's how I start all my conversations. All my disagreements begin with that.
Right. And so the shunning really is what was the thing that became the reason they split. Even at the time, the Amish had gone further than some in adopting, you know, manners of dress and worship practices that they have kept up for the last 300
years. They're not allowed to wear
years.
Colors other than black or white.
Right.
And so the Mennonites are a little bit different. They're allowed to wear colors other than black and white, but they are not to be flamboyant in their color.
Yes.
Hutterites, I don't know. I don't know how they dress. I think
it's similar to the Mennonites.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So this guy, I mean, that's a good segue to talk a little bit about the Anabaptist theology.
Yeah, that's what we really need to discuss.
Yes. So we can point to a historic document here, now usually referred to as the Schleitheim Confession from the town where it was adopted in 1527. It's by no means a full systematic theology, but it is the earliest Anabaptist statement of faith, so dated to February 24th of 1527. The full title...
Brotherly Union of a Number of Children of God Concerning 7 Articles.
Yes. Do you want to attempt the German?
Oh, man. I can't even speak my own native language, man. Bruderlich Vereinigung?
Yeah, that's pretty close, I think. I mean, I'm going off Google Translate here,
but that's only 2 words. How does all that?
Well, that's just the first 2 words.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, the brotherly union.
Bruderlich Vereinigung is the best I can do. But yeah, the brotherly union. So they basically boil it down to, they're not saying this is everything we believe, but they're saying here are 7 things we believe that kind of define why we're separating. So is probably most likely written by a guy named Michael Sattler. He lived from 1490 until 1527, the year that he wrote the Schleitheim Confession. And he had gone from being a Benedictine monk to almost kind of like a itinerant Anabaptist missionary, where
That's
he's going from town
shift.
To town. Oh, an incredible shift. But he would be arrested by Catholic authorities in the King Ferdinand, and he was king of part of Austria or Tyrol, but anyway, in Central Europe there.
Yeah.
And he was executed, and in a pretty gruesome fashion. All sorts of different stuff. Here's
what I know is that the Roman Catholics were pretty good at killing people.
Yes.
At this point.
Right.
At this point in time. Because they've already gone through how many crusades at this point? 3 or 4?
Oh, more than that. Yeah, I think so they were up to 7 or 8 at least by now.
They were very good at killing people.
Right. And
torturing people.
In that very area, 100 years before, they had a crusade against the Hussites. So even in this area, religious persecution was very well known. For Sattler, it was basically a version of being drawn and quartered and gruesomely murdered.
But did he cry out freedom?
No, that's a different guy. now, Ferdinand, who was the king, had said, well, the fitting execution for these Anabaptists is the third baptism. So they would drown them.
Wow.
Yes, so there were many Anabaptists who were executed by drowning, which is, I mean, I don't know, but it's always been described as, like, that's the most one of the most horrible ways to die. So, yeah, imagine you've staked your life on only adults should be baptized, and then, although apparently they baptize people by pouring and not by immersion, which,
yeah.
I mean, I think that is the proper mode, and you can make accommodation for that even in colder climates. But at the same time, I'm thinking getting baptized in a river in Central Europe in January does not sound very pleasant. You have to really be committed. You have to really mean it, and especially for these folks, for him, it was a matter of life and death. So, what are the 7 topics that the Schleitheim Confession covers?
That's less than the certain confessions of today of certain denominations.
Right, we got 7. Yeah,
that's obviously not very many.
They lead off with baptism.
That's probably their most important, right. I guess. Yeah,
excommunication, or what they call the ban. The Lord's Supper, separation from the world, shepherds or pastors, non-resistance.
Oh, they're pacifists.
They are, yes. And I can read you a sample here. Again, this is as published in Nick Needham's Volume 3 on we are agreed as follows concerning the sword. This is point number 6. God has ordained the sword outside the perfection of Christ among non-Christians. It punishes and puts to death the wicked and guards and protects the good. Under the law, meaning the Old Testament, the sword was ordained for the punishment of the wicked and for their death, and the same sword is now ordained to be used by worldly magistrates. In the perfection of Christ, however, the only discipline is the ban, used to warn and to excommunicate the one who has sinned, but without putting flesh to death, simply the warning and the command to sin no more. And then going back down, I mean, this extends, and they take this to its logical extension, where they say, quote, finally, it is not appropriate for a Christian to serve as a magistrate for these reasons. The magistracy, that's a hard one to say, magistracy of government is according to the flesh, but the Christian's government is according to the Spirit. Their houses and dwelling remain in the world, but the Christians are in heaven. Their citizenship is in this world, but the Christians' citizenship is in heaven. So that kind of gives you a flavor of what kind of things are in the Schleitheim Confession. And I think the separation from the world is one that's probably the most visible for most people, because it's easy to look at a community of the Old Order Amish or a Hutterite communal living situation, see, okay, I see what they're doing there. They're separating from the world by saying, this is how we're going to dress. It looks nothing like those people over there.
Yeah.
This is the technology that we're going to use, and it's very different in the case of the Amish from what is used in the world, or as they would say, by the English. We're all English. So there you go. There's the Schleitheim Confession. That's not all that can be said on their theology, though. And maybe now would be a good time to talk about Menno Simons?
Yeah, well, that was going to say, like, that's, there's some things there that would, reasons why we would say they don't have a proper view of the gospel.
Right.
And I think, and orthodoxy, Christian orthodoxy, I think at a bare minimum, I would say some, a lot their doctrines are heretical.
Mm-hmm.
But some people might argue that point. I don't see how, though.
Right.
They have a different gospel. It is not the gospel of Christ. So
yes.
It's works-based salvation.
Right. Absolutely. And we mentioned Menno Simons. So he is of the Dutch Anabaptists.
But so that's...
Go ahead.
When we talk about the doctrine of original sin, that, mm-hmm. that's kind of... I mean, it proves it there that they right. really believe that it's...
Oh, yeah. Yep.
It's only of grace if you're an infant.
Right. Correct. Well, which was part of... Which is part of the reason that Menno Simons would have said, we are not going to baptize infants, is right. that we don't need to.
Right.
Because they have no sin.
Right. But again, that also assumes and implies that baptism is necessary
right.
in order that one be saved.
Right. So, and it's really interesting because in so many ways they've separated from the Catholic Church and sometimes get lumped in with the Protestants.
Yeah.
But a lot of issues, they're a lot closer to the Roman Catholic yeah. Church than they are to the Reformers.
Yeah.
So it's definitely hard. You can't, they really just have to be in their own bucket.
Yeah.
You can't say Protestant bucket, Catholic bucket. They're their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you mentioned Erasmus. So he's writing against, Luther writes on the bondage of the will.
Right.
And Erasmus's work is De Libero Arbitrio.
Freedom of the will.
Right. It's the counterpart. And they would definitely, I mean, Anabaptists would definitely follow more in line with Erasmus, like you said.
Yeah.
Let's see. This is written by Balthasar Hubmaier, lived from about 1480.
That is always a name that I enjoy.
Yes, Balthasar yes. Hubmaier, 1480 to 1528. He's one of the South German Anabaptist leaders. He had been a Catholic priest. He had a doctor of theology at Ingolstadt University, so he's definitely qualified academically to dive into these theological issues, although we see he comes down on the wrong thing. And this is what he says of about the fall, how the flesh and the soul lost their freedom. He says, "But the spirit of man has remained utterly upright and intact before, during, and after the fall. For it did not in any way consent to or approve of the eating of the forbidden fruit by the flesh. But
what?
It was forced against its will as a prisoner in the body to participate in the eating. But the sin was not its own, but
what?
Rather that of the flesh and of the soul, for the latter had also become flesh."
Okay, hold on. So
right, yeah.
Wait. So there's a spirit. So there are...
Body, soul, and spirit.
Right.
And he's saying the body and the soul fell because they are the aspects of Adam and Eve that actually participated in the sin. But he says the spirit has maintained its inherited righteousness.
So he separates
in which it was
this
first
out of,
created.
Out of so then
yes,
that's. But again, to do that would be to separate. Christ is
yes, right,
like truly human,
mm-hmm.
before it has all of these things, and
right.
So then his that would make his spirit suffer for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it didn't need to be, our spirits don't need to be redeemed.
Right. They also reject the idea of election.
Well, so let's expound that a little bit.
Sure.
The idea of the need for Christ to die,
mm-hmm.
was so that he could atone, he could suffer that punishment. 2 Corinthians 5:21.
Mm-hmm.
Suffer that punishment that was due to us, all of our sin put on him, and by his death, burial, and resurrection, he redeems all of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And now, what I mean when I say all of humanity, I mean the entirety of that which is human, right? As we already discussed, our bodies and our souls. And so, if we want to say there's, you know, that the body and the soul only are that, so you're going to split that out, that means that all that was in Christ died, body, soul, spirit, but or whatever, all that was, in order for him to redeem all that was in man, he had to be all that was in man.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would mean that a certain part suffered that didn't need to for us
mm-hmm.
to redeem us.
Yeah.
That's the way I'm making it out in my head.
Right.
Which seems...
Well, yeah, and it's also connected to their doctrine of God and doctrine of Christ. So another good resource on this is a book called Heirs of the Reformation, Study in Baptist Origins by James McGoldrick, and it is available from Founders Press. The blurb on the back is from Dr. Tom Nettles, so you know it's nice. Good. And this, there's a chapter, and it covers a lot of history dating, I mean, going way back to the early church, the first couple centuries of the church, but brings it all the way up through the Anabaptists, and the chapter on the Anabaptists, whose forefathers is really great, and I think kind of blows out of the water the idea that we as Baptists grew out of the Anabaptist movement.
Right.
Just totally knocks it down. However, there's a lot of good information in this chapter, and one of those, he walks through their doctrines to show this has nothing to do with modern Baptists as
right.
we know it. It's just too different. So McGoldrick writes, beginning with Melchior Hoffman, early leader of the Dutch Brethren, and extending across the various phases of the movement to Menno Simons, Anabaptists held the view that Jesus Christ did not receive his physical body from the Virgin Mary. They believed that Jesus was born, quote, of Mary, but that he brought his flesh from heaven and passed through Mary's body as water passes through a pipe.
So he wasn't human.
I mean, it's basically like a celestial flesh view. Let's see. As Hoffman stated the matter, quote, if Christ had taken our flesh from Mary, it must be the accursed flesh of Adam, and then he could not have been our Redeemer. There's another guy that writes, his name is Bernard Rothman, and he was involved in the... Munsterite Rebellion. We talked about that
very briefly.
Last summer, I think, when he talked with Ottavio.
That's right.
And here's what Rothman writes: if it had been Mary's flesh, that is Christ born of Mary, that died for us, what comfort and courage could we derive from that? That would be like paying for one sin with another, and a wash and cleanse one uncleanness with another. Menno Simons wrote extensively about the incarnation and expressed his subscription to the view of Christ's humanity, sometimes called celestial flesh. Menno's expositions show that he was determined and defensive in maintaining this position in Christology. So they have a view of the incarnation that really is the ancient heresy of Docetism.
Yeah.
That Jesus, he did not actually become a flesh and blood person, but he looked like a person. He looked like one of us, but he really never was God incarnate in flesh.
Right, right. Yeah. And the Roman Catholic Church actually has a doctrine that covers that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, they got around that by saying, oh, well, there was an incarnate, an immaculate conception.
Right.
And that immaculate conception happened when Mary's mother and father
right.
created her,
mm-hmm.
or what's the proper term? Not created, because they, I mean,
conceived.
Thank you. When they conceived Mary, it was without original sin. So Mary, this is why they get away with calling her, they don't get away with, but this is why they, in their mind, in their systematic, are able to call her the co-mediatrix,
right?
Which is absolute nonsense. It is,
yes,
false. So, but it is a problem, right? I mean, how mm-hmm. do we deal with this? And I don't know how I dealt with it before. I guess mm-hmm. as a Roman Catholic, it was really very simple. We just said, oh, yeah, Immaculate
right.
Conception. Mary was without sin. That was why she had to be without sin, because she couldn't carry something that was holy, and Jesus was holy.
Mm-hmm.
But if we understand the garden and where that sin is passed down from, we can say, yes, because Jesus had no earthly father, there was no seminal passing of that original sin,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is where that sin comes from. And every single person born of original means, right, is is going to receive that from their father. But Jesus, not having an earthly father, did not receive that sin.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that's how we can say.
Right.
That's how I believe is the Orthodox proper view
right.
of Christ becoming fully human without inheriting original sin.
Right.
Yep. We don't have to make Mary something that she's not.
No.
She was a sinner in need of God's grace and mercy.
Mm-hmm. One of the other, just foundational doctrines for the Reformation is salvation by faith alone, or sola fide, if you mm-hmm. want to go with your five solas. And so, I don't remember where I saw it now, but somebody was asking, like, how many of the solas can you reject before you're not a Protestant anymore? I'm like, well, none of them.
Oh, you'd be,
Well, yeah.
Find me, going, never mind. I don't want to. I'm just saying there's a lot of folks that.
Yes.
Attend Protestant churches that don't even know what the five solas are.
This is true, yes. And I think, well, back in 2017, we did a Wednesday night thing.
Yeah, it was. And I'm almost dead certain that people that were there did not listen to a single thing that was said.
That's anywhere. Yeah. But yeah, it was like in the 500th anniversary, like, this is really important. We should get a hold of this and understand where it came from and how we got here.
And God bless the brother who actually taught that. He's actually teaching as a missionary church history in Africa.
Yeah. But the Anabaptist denied the Reformed statement of salvation by faith alone, and frequently just they denied it explicitly. Like you said, Martin Luther says this, and we say, no way, man, that's not true. They also would have denied, they would say, well, we're not Roman Catholic in our doctrine of salvation, but when you read what they said, it's much, like I said before, it's much closer to the Roman Catholic idea of salvation. Again, here's Melchior Hoffman explaining election in terms which make human choice the sole determinant. And this is as cited in the James McGoldrick book. He says, all men are called, but no one has been elected except for them who have struggled through to victory. And in case all of them struggle... Right. And in case all of them struggle and conquer, all of them should also be elected by God. Yes, even the whole world. They who have once struggled and conquered are then elected by God... so that they will not depart from Christ and the eternal temple of God. So, yeah, it's definitely a synergistic view of salvation.
They have a doctrine of God problem.
They have a doctrine of God problem. They have a doctrine of salvation problem.
Yeah.
They have a doctrine of the church problem.
Once you get the doctrine of God wrong, like it's...
Everything else is going to... It's downhill from there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean...
But
go ahead.
This idea from Menno Simons was actually something that's very prevalent today. Now, most Baptists will acknowledge, or let's say Protestants, most Protestants will acknowledge that there's men are in need of a Savior, mm-hmm. that we all sin. But when you start talking about children, then it gets a lot more dicey.
Oh, yes.
And then it becomes, well, there's this idea of there's an age of accountability at which point now...
Right.
They've got to earn their salvation. If they had died before this point, God's grace would have covered them and they would have been saved by his mercy alone. But now that they're at the age of accountability, quote, now they have to receive the salvation.
Right. Yes. So, yeah, definitely has roots there in the Anabaptists, and it is still with us in a lot of churches.
A lot of churches.
Mm-hmm. I grew up.
I haven't attended. I've only attended two churches in my entire life, right? And we both go to those. But the reason I'm able to say this, I say like a lot of churches, is not because I've been member of a lot of churches, but I've had many conversations with a lot of people that call themselves Christians that are in churches that are otherwise Orthodox,
right?
And they believe this.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was. When it wasn't taught explicitly in the church context in which I grew up, I think it was mostly assumed. Mm. And, I really only remember going to one church growing up, but it was a large church in that independent fundamental Baptist world. So we would have a lot of guest preachers come through, a lot of guest speakers for chapel when I was in high school and college. So I got to hear a lot. And I would think I would have to say, in my experience, it's a very common viewpoint.
Yeah.
And there are various attempts at justification for how do you derive that viewpoint from scripture.
Right.
And you know,
well, most people won't even go near scripture with that.
Oh, right.
It's just a sin. Well, that's too harsh for my
yes.
For me to comprehend. It hurts my sensibilities.
Right.
Right.
And yeah.
I can't handle that. God would not.
I just can't believe in a God that would fill in a blank, which is
oh my
which gosh. Is terrible.
And when you hear that from a head pastor, a senior pastor, that's really bad.
That's not good.
Yeah.
So, I guess, how long have we been talking? A while.
Probably a bit.
Time flies when you're having fun, right?
Yeah.
So a little while, but I wanted to bring us up to the modern day because, as we talked about, you've met someone who grew up in a Hutterite community.
Yeah.
So they're definitely still out there, but the Mennonites have only continued to grow since the 1500s, got larger and larger. And I had some numbers, and these were interesting to me, but these are statistics compiled by the Mennonite World Conference as of 2018. So about 3 years ago, but that's the most recent numbers that they have. They don't do it every year. They claim that there are about 2.1 million Anabaptists around the world in about 17,000 congregations. Now that's including, I'm pretty sure that includes the Old Order Amish, as well as the Mennonites, the Hutterites, German Brethren, Swiss Brethren, all those kind of things. Of those 2.1 million, there are about 500,000 in the United States. So what's that, about 25%? Another 150,000 in Canada. Now, this I thought was extremely interesting for a group or a movement that got its start in a very small area in Switzerland, South Germany, and the Netherlands. There are over 750,000 Anabaptists in Africa.
Whoa.
And in Ethiopia by itself in Ethiopia, there are roughly five times more Anabaptists than in Europe as a whole.
Wow.
Yeah, so there's about 60, they count about 60-some thousand Anabaptists in Europe. They count about 300,000 Anabaptists in Ethiopia.
Wow.
And most of those...
almost, that tiny little country, almost as many there as there are here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Ethiopia is one of the larger countries in Africa.
Yes. Well, our maps are woefully inaccurate. But they're not 300...
Right. So. They don't have 330 million people either. Right. They're a large country for Africa, but yeah, not as large as the United States. But yeah, about 310,000 Anabaptists are counted in Ethiopia by itself, where you have less than 50,000 in Germany. And so now a movement that started in Europe makes up less than 3% of all the Anabaptists around the world. So they're growing by leaps and bounds in Africa and Asia, where there's just hundreds of thousands of these congregants. So
that's
it's just
sad.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you can look at it also. A lot of the fastest growing churches are also the Mormon churches, because they send
and
out missionaries.
And heretical churches, right, of the prosperity gospel in Latin America.
Right, Latin America and Africa.
Yeah.
Africa too.
That one. So it's interesting, right? And this is a bit of a sidebar here, but, you know, I am not one to be wholly identified with someone simply because we share a culture.
Right. Right.
Except Texans, because yes, there is no better culture.
Always.
Yeah. But man, I gotta say, when I found out that, you know, this prosperity garbage was just completely taking over Latin American countries, man, like that kind of got to me a little bit. I'm like, man, this is, are there no, and this is why I love Paul Washer. I love Brother Paul Washer, because he went down there and that was his motivation. Is
right.
Not because these people look like me and we share a culture, but to make God's glory known.
Yeah.
And so look, I know for everybody that's listening, you one listener in the dark somewhere, our one fan. No, I guess we have a couple, even out of the state, and that's really cool. But yes. Listen, we have these conversations and we do not begin to think that we have all the answers about what is right and what is true ultimately. We believe very strongly that what we hold to is a historic faith, and it is true, right and true, the Second London Baptist Confession of Faith, 1689. And we just want to do our best to help others. We don't in any way think we're better than others because we hold to this confession of faith and not some other.
Mm-hmm.
We love all of those that hold to the true Christian faith. And we hope that anything that we do here is edifying to those. If nothing else, goodness gracious, I hope it causes you to go search for your own answers.
Yes.
To find out, like, right. Is this really true? Let me go look for myself. Yeah. Because so, it matters.
It does. So we'll drop some links to some source materials
Yes. In
the show notes page, because we're going to cite our sources.
Absolutely.
And you can, I mean, there's tons of reading you can do. I actually did some reading on archive.org. Have you ever used this?
What is that?
Well, primarily I had used it in the past for searching for old versions of web pages.
Oh, like whenever...
Like the web archive.
Like, right, yeah. So, like, if you endorse a group that does research, but then you want to, like, have that removed, you could go look that up and say, hey,
yes,
what did I actually say?
Yes, you could do that.
Okay, cool.
But it archives old copies of web pages, so you can look at, you know, like, the Washington Post or whatever from 2002.
And it doesn't get changed or altered?
Well, they're archiving it. That's why it's called the Web Archive, archive.org.
So it's unchangeable. In its form, the form that it's
correct,
saved in.
Okay. Right? It's frozen in time. Yeah, like they take a snapshot. Yeah, it's very useful for that. But I also discovered recently that they have like 2 or 3 million books online, like
free?
Full books. You have to sign up, so you create a free account. But right, and then you can borrow them. You can borrow them for an hour, or you can borrow them for
who
2 weeks.
The world would borrow a book for an hour?
If you just had to do like a little bit of research, I actually did it a couple of times this week. Yeah, I am that guy. But there's some great resources on there. So I did a little bit of reading about the Anabaptists. And sometimes what you can do is like we use Wikipedia. Come on.
Well,
it's like the encyclopedia.
Right. So my professors always told me if you must use Wikipedia, go to the cited works.
Yes.
And then go
right.
to that.
Right. So I was going to say, that's how it's useful. It's kind of like the big Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yeah.
Although anybody
What's
can
an
edit
encyclopedia?
It. Right, yeah. Encyclopedia. But you can do that. You can go and on the good articles, at the bottom, they'll have the sources. And what you can do is you can take that list, go to archive.org, and often you can find a lot of those books. And some of them are old. Maybe you could get them through like an interlibrary loan or something like that, but that usually costs like a few bucks.
You're supposed to have access to Regent's Library, don't you?
Maybe.
I know I got access to Liberty's Library.
I probably do. I just haven't taken advantage of it. Now I live over here.
I forget my password, and then I'm like, I forget my password, and then I have to contact somebody, and they have to reset it for me, and then it's just a mess. And
yeah.
So I've done it. I've used it, even for research on this.
So.
Which they make you sign a statement saying you can't reuse it for monetary gain. I'm like,
I'm definitely not getting money on this. Yeah,
I'm good.
Well, that's I guess a really long-winded way to say that you don't have to take our word for it.
Absolutely not.
You can go, and if we pique your interest on something, you can go and do a deep dive more than we have the time to get into here, even though we've kind of talked ourselves for a while now. But that's all right.
Oh, that's not typical.
That's not even that bad.
Yeah, that's about a normal episode.
But you know. Get involved in the conversation. So, you know, find us on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or email us. But, you know, we'd love to hear from you. Keep those reviews coming. There's one site that tracks our rankings.
Yeah.
On iTunes.
And it helps to have reviews.
Yeah, it does help to have reviews. We recently dropped out of the top 100 Christianity podcasts in Oman.
Yeah.
I don't know how we got in the top 100.
Oh, Oman.
Oman, wow. Yes. Like, I don't know.
Who in the world was there?
I have no idea.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah. So we're big in Oman, I guess. Not yeah. Tokyo. All right. Yeah. I think that's it. Thanks for being with us. Hope you enjoyed the conversation, and we look forward to talking with you again.
All right, guys. Bye.